Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to this episode of the Colorado Review Podcast, in partnership with the Center for Literary Publishing at Colorado State University. This is your host, C. Culbertson, and today I sit down with Leonora Simonovis, whose book Study of the Raft won the Colorado Prize for Poetry in 2021. We talk about writing from multilingual backgrounds, the worlds we construct from childhood, memory, and place, as well as modes of writing poetry, and what it means to write poetry today. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you too. So I wanted to begin by inviting you to read a poem for us.
So I'm going to read At the Airport. The young woman stands like an unmoored sentence, red-rimmed eyes roaming the crowds. Next to her, a young man, her boyfriend, and her mother. He lifts his hand as if wanting to touch the parts of her he wants to remember, but the woman has already turned the page. Sometimes the only way out is to step into the fable of another existence. Every few minutes, a flash of military green, raised voices, another passenger detained and hassled for a few dollars. Things to remember. You are a one-way ticket. Say goodbye, not hasta luego. To leave is to tune into your own unraveling, to understand that forever is also never. The woman holds her loved ones, stands up, wobbles, straightens. Call us when you get to the gate, the mother says.
Thank you. I'm so struck by the lines, sometimes the only way out is to step into the fable of another existence. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about the way that poetry sort of constructs a world, mm-hmm. I think. So as to get into your book, I'm interested in how the poetry collection generally, again, constitutes a world. Mm-hmm. An account of how language functions and what poetry can do. I think when we're writing, the language we choose, the form, the way the poem lays on the page, it constructs a certain way of speaking and a way of seeing. Mm. There's so many poems, particularly in the beginning of your collection, that are interested in world building. With this in mind, what sort of account of the world does Study of the Raft enact?
That's a great question. I want to say a world where beauty can be found in spite of destruction and in spite of the ugliness of it. It is a world where loss is prevalent, the loss of language, the loss of stories, the loss of family, where grief is pretty much at the tip of the tongue. All the time and everything you say and do. But when I wrote the book, I was seeking for something on the other side. Having been through the whole process of being an immigrant and what that means in this country, which is different for everyone. But for me, it was a process of accepting and adjusting, not assimilating, but sort of rebuilding myself as well. So it was also a process of accepting that world that I had to recreate for myself in order to feel comfortable here. And it's taken, I mean, I've been in this country for this time for almost 15 years. I lived here as a child, but it's taken me all this time to really process what it means to be an immigrant and what it means to be me today, now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what we call me or us is so guided or, I don't know, formed by the landscapes that we inhabit, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And one thing that struck me about your book is that it moves through so many different landscapes. Mm-hmm. And it feels so particular to the work, in fact. And especially in the early the early poems, I feel I really see childhood for you or for your speaker. This sort of tension between family self, and then you take up this tension between self and gender as well.
Right.
Public and revolution. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the landscape or the backdrop against which your poems speak?
Yeah, definitely. And I actually was teaching a class when I started thinking about some of these poems, and it was a theory and methods class, but one of the readings we did was on maps and how maps are constructed and who gets to decide what goes on the map, the sizing of the countries and the land masses and the everything else. And so I started thinking about how internal and external landscapes are related and connected. Land is very important for me. My the women in my family, my mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, they all, in one way or another, had a connection to the land. And one of the things that I was remembering recently is when my mother, when I asked as a child, why don't we go to Disney and why don't we go to Europe or whatever? Because it's what everyone was doing. Instead of saying, because we don't have the means for it, because I, you know, it was true. She said, because you have to know your own country first before you get to know other countries. You have to know the land you're from, because that's who you are. It's a part of who you are. And so I think I brought that into this book as well. Those external landscapes and what's happening to them in this so-called revolution, red revolution or 21st century revolution, as they called it. But what's happening to the land is also happening to us. What's happening to the landscapes, you know, the pollution. I mean, there's so much pollution. Nobody talks about that in the Amazon rainforest. Indigenous people are being persecuted for protesting against this. They're being tortured and killed. And so everything that goes on the outside is affecting us in the inside as well. And so I wanted to reflect that and to tell my story and to tell it from the perspective of a child, because this is not new. It's been going on for a while. And as a child, how I felt so helpless, how I was listening to all these conversations that the adults were having about the economic crisis and the political upheavals and the social changes and how they were also lost. They didn't know what to do. And all we could do is just keep going, keep living, right? And continue to tell the story and to pass them on to next to the future generations.
That seems so prescient today as we consider the kind of this mashup of globalism that seems to be ever changing,
yes.
You know, in our current sphere.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about language and the way that this sort of, being multilingual, this tension between indigenous and colonizer languages, mm-hmm. you know, the ways we speak at home versus the way we speak or are mm-hmm. spoken to by the state.
Right.
You know, can you speak to how language functions in your work and what mm-hmm. kind of multilingualism you try to portray?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. Languages have been prevalent in my life since I was very little. We were exposed to all kinds of languages, like European and also indigenous languages. In the city, in Caracas, there were lots of Italian and Portuguese immigrants, and also immigrants from Spain, but from like Galicia and the Basque Country, who speak a completely different, they call it dialect. I like to call it language. It's a language too. And just listening to all of that, I think for me, my main sense is sound. So that soundscape, I wanted it to come through as well in the book, because part of it was noise, but part of it was just being exposed to all these ways of seeing the world and sort of absorbing everything. And in regards to indigenous culture, my so-called fairy tales, the first ones I read as a kid, were from indigenous groups in the Amazon rainforest. Like again, my mother wanted us to get to know who we were as a people, right? Who the first inhabitants of our land were. And so I remember she went to this bookstore and she brought home, like, I still have them. There are like five or six books that had indigenous stories. And they're like my favorite ones. I actually have them, read to my kids, and I have them read them and all that. And so that, not the language itself, because they were written in Spanish, they were translated, but the cosmology, like the worldview that they were showing, was completely different to European fairy tales. And so, I grew up like not with these things being opposed to each other, but actually living and dialoguing and conversing in this same world. And so in terms of like the languages that I speak, English and Spanish, they're not in opposition to each other. It's not a binary. They're, sort of like mingling and mixing, and sometimes, one takes over, sometimes the other, but they just live inside of me, both of them. And in a way, I think I am trying to get away from that way of seeing the world as, good and evil, male, female, English, Spanish, or whatever, right? That binary way of seeing, which I think has been very detrimental to culture and social relations in general.
I think that there's a way that how Study of the Raft sort of shows us a way that we can both be critical of language's power, right? But also use it at the same time. Because it is the way we speak, right? Right. We can't get away outside of it, really. And I think that that speaks to really what poetry does. I mean, as poets, we are so ensconced with language and with ways of speaking and, telling stories and creating worlds. Looking inside and outside of your work, I wonder if you could speak to this. What is poetry's capacity to engender, to bring about, to foment? I find that stories like yours really bring me out of my own skin, and there's so much to take in and places to be taken to.
Yeah, thank you. That's beautiful. I would say literature in general has a way of teaching us about the world in a way that textbooks don't. And that I learned that at a very early age. I love to read. I actually, my mother always told me when I was like 3 or 4, I was like, "You need to teach me how to read. I don't care. I'm not in school. I want to learn to read." And she taught me, and I just grabbed the books. And I have some of my books that I read as a kid, and they're all like, marked with pencil, because I wanted to also rewrite those stories in my own way. And so I think that poetry for me has a way of, I'm trying to find the word, it has a way of showing us the world more directly, I guess. Because even though we are working with language and we are somewhat following rules, we can also break those rules, right? We don't have to write syntactically, syntactically correct sentence so that, it makes sense. We rely on images, on metaphor, on figurative language. I mean, all these things that make a poem a poem, right? And it reminds me of Buddhism and the way in which we are always living in this illusion and can't really come close to reality unless we actually sit down and, meditate and reflect and take things for what they are, taking them at face value, right? It's an object. I mean, it's, let's say I'm looking at a horse. I'm not going to start, you know, trying to conceptualize the horse in my head, because then it stops being a horse and it begins to be something else, right? I'm constructing it rather than just looking at the horse and seeing it for what it is. It's a horse. I think that is very simple and complex at the same time. And I think poetry gives us that. You know, I've read poems that are, that look very, I don't know, sparse and concrete on the page, and that seem to give a very simple account of something, but then you read them over and over, and every time it's different, right? And they give you so much more than what you were expecting. And I'm thinking about Lucille Clifton, for example, or Jane Kenyon. I mean, just incredible poets who did so much with this like sparseness and simplicity of language.
I feel like there's two directions we could go, because I'm hearing something about the way that the poem lays on the page, but also mm-hmm. hearing another dialogue about inheritances and right. what kind of, you know, you talked earlier about the books that your mother collected and that you mm-hmm. now have, and you know, those count as inheritances, I'm sure, but right. then also Lucille Clifton mm-hmm. And others. So let's go ahead and start with that. So inside or outside of poetry, you know, we're always finding ways to get ourselves, you know, onto the page, mm-hmm. In our writing desk, whatever form that takes, and make marks upon it. So what is that for you? What are your go-tos? What are you, what's your lineage?
Wow. That's a, that's a huge one. And I also feel like I go in so many directions. I have several ways of getting on the page. Reading is one of them. And sometimes it can either be reading a children's book, or it could be reading a poetry book, or reading fiction, a novel, or reading for my classes as I prep. I can find inspiration in that. A lot of times I listen to different podcasts, not just on poetry or literature, but like nature, you know, wildlife, ecology, things like that. And listening to those sometimes, I'm driving and I'm like, oh my gosh, that line, it's amazing. I have to write it down. Or, you know, I come up with an idea thanks to that, you know, conversation in the podcast. But I think for me, writing is kind of an embodied practice. I am in my body a lot. I used to be a competitive swimmer. I did martial arts for a long time. And that tradition of the martial arts and the connection with another person, not in fighting, but in a way, like getting in touch with their energy and knowing what it feels like to actually sort of be with that other person's center of gravity. What does it mean, right? Like, it's very intimate. And I think all of those practices, yoga as well, have led me to prepare by being in my body first before I actually write. And I actually write by hand a lot. And when I feel like I have revised enough, then I type up on the page on the computer. But in general, it has to be something physical. And it could be also like grasping an object and feeling it in my hands, or going outside and listening to, you know, the birds or the ocean or whatever it is. Not because I'm writing about that, but because I need that sensory input in order to be able to get on the page in a mindful way. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I myself go out on walks or just mm-hmm. stand yes. out in my backyard. And it's, for me, it's needing that kind of that isolation, that moment to just feel myself. And right. I'm really understanding what you're saying. But yeah, just being in your body and somehow that, I don't know, it gets something flowing. And I'll often think about a line, you know, as I'm driving or as I'm, you know, outside.
Yes.
And then I'm racing to my notebook to try to put it down before I forget.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Yeah.
And it's great, especially like if you're walking outside and you see something, and I don't always take a notebook with me because I'm usually with my dogs and I really don't have, you know, I have only two hands, so I can't stop and write something down. So I record it on the phone, or I've done this where I repeat it to myself until I get home and then I write it down. It's like a mantra, right?
You know, so when you do get to the, and this is, I don't know, maybe one of those questions you kind of have to ask everyone when they come into the studio, but when you do get to your desk or to your notebook or whatever, what is your process? You said that you wrote by hand. Are you finding that it's like a sort of an act of composition, of transcription, or like how do you kind of get into the mode get the words on the page?
So as you're saying that, I'm thinking about, you know, those gummy worms, you know, like, and you open it and you just, you know, put them in a bowl and it's all this like wriggling, messy kind of thing. So that's what, to me, what it looks like on the page. Usually I start with a line or an idea and I go from there, but I always end up somewhere else. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to write about this. And I start. And then as I keep writing, it's not about that. It's something, you know, related, but completely different. And I don't always do free writing. I do a lot of it. But sometimes I just give myself a prompt and I do some mindful writing, or I call it mindful writing, which is something where I'm very aware of what I'm doing and my train of thought. It's like a meditation. And so I am either reflecting on something, or I'm describing, then reflecting, going a little bit with the whole poetic structure. Or, you know, I copy down a phrase that I find ironic and then I try to go off of that and see where that leads me. Or I write like an abecedarian. And so I just grab the dictionary and start, oh, okay, this is cool. I start writing words and going with that. And I like to alternate between the two, because free writing I find helpful to an extent, but I don't know if it's maybe because of my own, you know, physical practices in, you know, mindfully walking or doing yoga or meditating, that it really does help to do writing in a mindful way, in a more conscious way. And I'm not necessarily talking about like revising or editing, but just like writing on the page and looking at, I guess, as you're writing, you're being present with it, and you're also being present with what's going on in your body and your mind at the same time. Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. I like that. Well, now I'm thinking of form. And and I notice in Study of the Raft, there's a few different ways that the poems appear, you know, particularly Maps, which is the first poem, is fielded out a little bit, use of white space, and it's kind of striated across the page. And then there's other poems like Still Life with Smoked Landscape, which is divided into tight couplets and stays in the right hand margin.
Right.
And then there's poems like Legends, which sort of has a, I don't know what you would call it, but a subtitle of sorts. And then a tercet that follows. What are these different ways of putting the poem on the page do? Like what, how is form working for you and how are you conceiving of it?
Yeah. So when I was writing, especially maps and legends, I wanted the form to reflect the content in some way. And so, maps has that sort of blank space and across the page kind of structure because I was thinking about a literal map and what that looks like on the page, but also those blank spaces because it is about colonization represent what has been lost, right? And what cannot be recovered. And so, towards the end of the poem, I was trying to, as I kind of, make this stanzas a little bit more compact, trying to create a new story from that loss, right? And sort of what can we gain from it? Do we gain anything from it? I kept asking those questions to myself. Like, what do we have now after that loss? And what can we recover? And if we do, how can we archive it or pass it on to the future generations? And so I was trying to do that with maps. And then legends actually had a completely different structure. It was, as I'm trying to remember, but I think it was all tercets. And it didn't have the what I call the definitions or the words next to them. But my partner said, well, it's called legends. There's, every map has legends. So why don't you think about that and do something with that? And I was like, oh, yes. And that's when it became what it is now. But I also wanted there to be some continuity, which is why all those words are connected to each other. And I was thinking about layers in history, the layering in history, but also how that reflects in the landscape. And so, according to the history of Caracas, the city of Caracas, the mountain that surrounds the valley of the city used to be part of the ocean or used to be underwater, right? And then at some point, it just, as the ocean started to recede and everything started to dry, it just became the landmass that is now around the city. And I was thinking about that and how Indigenous people knew about all these stories, but they don't appear in history books. And so, how the word legend can play to both things, like the legend in a map, but also the legends that we hear that are not part of official history, but that become stories that are orally transmitted. And so I was trying to play in most of the poems with the relationship between form and content. And I also played with some, traditional forms like sonnets and pantomimes, but then they served as a starting point for what the poems became, eventually became.
I want to ask, as we're kind of getting toward the end here, what are you reading right now? Or, what should our readers be reading?
Oh, let's see. Well, I'm reading right now The Art of Syntax by Ellen Bryan Boyd. And it's a book I've been wanting to read for a while because I do teach grammar in Spanish. And I find that doing that has inspired my writing, ironically. I used to not like teaching grammar. And I'm thankful to my students because it's through their questions that I started seeing it in a different way. And so I'm reading that, and I'm reading Carl Phillips' Coin of the Realm, which are essays on poetry, and I love it. As far as poetry, I've been rereading Bishop, mostly because I'm revising some poems and like at least three people were like, you know what? You should probably read, remember this poem by Bishop? And I'm thinking, okay, so that's three out of three. So I should probably go back and read it. So I'm rereading all of her selected poems. As far as shoulds, I don't usually do shoulds, but I always recommend reading Clifton. Like Anything and Everything by Clifton. Russ Gay is another author that I absolutely love, and I could reread his work over and over. I was thinking about Jane Kenyon recently too, because she's one of the poets that I find I can relate to in terms of the way she writes. And I don't think a lot of people read her much. And gosh, I like so many poets, you know, Dennis Smith and Paige Lewis, Kaveh Akbar. I mean, I could make a list and it would go pages and pages long. But I've also been reading recently published poets that are either friends or that I've met somehow in a workshop. And my friend Jerry Fredrickson published a book called You Are Not Lost, which is beautiful. Amanda Moore published Requeening Poetry Collection. And I'm sure there's more, but right now I'm blanking on.
Thank you. That's a good list to go and discover some more of what's out there. So, but you said how you were revising some poems. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you working on something new? Is there something in process?
There is. I just don't know what it is yet. But these are poems that I wrote last spring, as I was sort of waiting to hear back from all the submissions I had done on the book. And also my mother was very ill at the time. And so I was trying to find a way to sort of keep my mind occupied. And so a lot of these poems are landscape related. I watched several documentaries on like ice, Greenland, the polar ice caps melting. There's a lot of doom, but there's also so many interesting things. And a lot of memories from childhood start coming up about places that we visited and that today are sort of endangered. And so I'm thinking about climate change and how it's affecting not only, you know, the United States, because we talk about that a lot here, but how is it affecting other places in the world and indigenous communities that I, you know, grew up with, and the places that, you know, that had snow, for example, that I visited as a child in Venezuela, and how the snow is basically disappearing now. And I can't really imagine that. You know, I've looked at the pictures, but it's hard for me to picture it, because what does that mean as that landscape sort of recedes or disappears or transforms? How does my experience transform as well? And my own story, my own connection to it. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. So the poems that I'm revising have a lot to do with it, but I'm not sure exactly, you know, I don't have like a project in mind at the moment. Maybe I do, and it's like subconsciously pulling me in that direction, but
yeah. No, I'll definitely be checking out your author's page and hopefully seeing some of these out in the world. That's so interesting though, and I don't know if this is a question exactly, but when writing about climate change and the way that you were speaking to it, I wonder if there's a way that sort of poetics is speculative.
Yes.
Yeah. Definitely. I don't know if you could speak to that.
So I actually took a speculative poetry workshop years ago with Winter Tangerine. And the exercises were amazing because they really had me going out of my comfort zone. to write about things that I would never think about. It was a lot of, you know, like imagining things that were completely surreal and beyond, you know, what you see every day. And so I've been pulling out some of those prompts. I still have them, and rereading them and thinking, how can I apply this to what I'm interested in now? And the speculation part is so hard for me, because I don't, and I think this is the academic in me, the scholar, you know, it's like, maybe I don't want to say this, but that's something that I still struggle with, you know, like working in academia and teaching, and teaching students how to write critically and how to cite and properly provide evidence and all this stuff. And then on the other hand, I'm you know, making up as I go in my own work. And so I think that I want to explore that speculative side more, but I also need to read more. And so, yeah, I'm starting to kind of look into that as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So as we started this conversation with the poem, I wondered if you would read another poem to close.
Yeah, definitely. So I will read Katsaridaphobia, which is fear of cockroaches. It wasn't so much the smell of rancid oil, but how they starred the ceiling, many-legged nightmares falling on our beds. If I paid attention, I could see their constellations shifting. I called them Azabache, Canela, Luna, Lucero, like the horses we rode at the farm. Tame, familiar. Mama scolded me for not killing them, but the sound of death is not meant for every ear. How many times did I panic when wings smacked my body, when legs skittered on an arm or leg? The only time I stepped on a roach, the scene repeated in my head like a horror film. I kept looking at the corpse, unnerved by postmortem spasms. It's easier to run, brush the fear away, but maybe I should have asked them, what is my name?
Thank you for listening. That was this month's episode. Next episode, editorial assistant Sarah Hughes sits down with Cynthia Parker Ohene, whose book Daughters of Harriet was recently selected for the Colorado Review's Mountain West Poetry Series.